From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the director of The Conformist, Last Tango in Paris, and The Last Emperor. We talk with Bernardo Bertolucci. His latest film, Little Buddha, is about a young boy who turns out to be a reincarnated Tibetan Lama. Bertolucci went to the Dalai Lama to get his approval before making the film. Also, from pro baseball's first all-female team, who, by the way, scored their first run last night, we meet pitcher Lisa Martinez and manager Phil Niekro of the Colorado Silver Bullets. And world music commentator Milo Miles looks at old and new releases of bossa nova guitarist Baden Powell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Lawyers for the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Dan Rostenkowski, are seeking a plea bargain to avoid a lengthy criminal trial. The New York Times and the Chicago Sun-Times have reported today that defense attorney Robert Bennett is trying to convince prosecutors that Rostenkowski's spending rather than criminal penalties. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Weeks ago, U.S. Attorney Eric Holder recommended to the Justice Department that Rostenkowski be indicted. In such high-profile investigations, sometimes defense lawyers are allowed to make their case with prosecutors before an indictment is handed down. The newspaper reports today indicate that Rostenkowski's lawyer, Robert Bennett, is having discussions with prosecutors to avoid a broad criminal indictment. The investigation is centered on Rostenkowski's use of his office and campaign funds and whether he improperly received money in stamp transactions from the House Post Office. If Rostenkowski is indicted, he must step aside as chairman in the middle of debate over health care. The White House considers him critical to passage of health care legislation. Other options would include allowing the House to consider censuring Rostenkowski or imposing civil rather than criminal penalties against him. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Congress is working on health care reform. Republicans and Democrats are disagreeing on how to write the legislation. Republican members of the Senate Labor and Human Resources Committee have 91 amendments to the health care reform bill before them. The bill is similar to the president's, but it drops the requirement that consumers buy health insurance from big mandatory alliances. Opponents say there is still too much bureaucracy in the bill. The House Ways and Means Committee has also taken up its own legislation. Democrat Pete Stark is upset with the GOP committee members. He alleges they're standing in the way of health reform. A consumer group says that washing and peeling fruit often fails to get rid of pesticide residue. The Environmental Working Group is citing studies from the Agriculture Department to back up its claim. Richard Wiles is a researcher with the Environmental Working Group. He says often more than one kind of pesticide residue is left over.
Two or more pesticides were found on nearly 60% of the peach samples, over 50% of the apple samples, and 40% of the grapes. At the high end of the multiple residue profile, one out of every 10 apples, peach, and serving of celery had four or more pesticides on it after it was washed and prepared for normal consumer consumption.
Food industry officials say the report is misleading and the food supply is safe. Other officials say this group is doing consumers a grave disservice. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up more than 26 points at 3,759. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq is up 5 points. This is NPR. The Senate has voted to ease federal drinking water requirements. The vote was 95-3. State and local officials have complained that current law is too rigid. Congress has been under increasing pressure to make the federal law more flexible. Mayors and governors say they're forced to spend money they don't have to deal with water contaminants that aren't threats. Environmentalists are denouncing the law. They say it will make drinking water less safe. The issue must now be taken up by the House. A mortar shell struck the main hospital in the Rwandan capital, Kigali, today. Shells have also been landing near a compound used by the United Nations. And a Red Cross convoy came under fire outside the city today. The BBC's Roger Hearing has this report.
The hospital in a government-held area was hit during one of the exchanges of fire that occur several times a day in Kigali. The hospital holds many wounded soldiers as well as civilians injured in the fierce fighting that's paralyzed the city over the past 6 weeks. Mortars are used by both sides, as well as heavier artillery, in attacking the entrenched positions the soldiers have now taken up. Accidental hits against nearby buildings are a regular occurrence, including places clearly marked as UN, Red Cross or hospital premises. The UN says it's checking on the exact number of casualties at the hospital. Its military observers said the mortar had been fired from one of the hills overlooking the city. Dr. Abdul Kabir, executive director of the UN's operation in Rwanda, said there was no military advantage in attacking the hospital, and he hoped it had not been deliberately targeted.
Roger Hearing reporting. The government says the U.S. trade deficit shrank in March by 18.5%. The Commerce Department says the trade imbalance was measured at nearly $7.5 billion. That's better than February's record of little more than $9 billion. The agency says a big jump in exports led the way. There were increases in U.S. sales of gold bullion, airplanes, and telecommunications products. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. Bernardo Bertolucci's films tend to cause a stir. The controversial Last Tango in Paris was banned and got him convicted for obscenity in Italy. His four-hour epic 1900 was a grand commercial flop. Then, in 1988, The Last Emperor won 9 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director. Richard Corliss wrote in Time magazine that in the 60s, Bertolucci was a charter member of the first generation of directors who were bred to break the rules of narrative film. His was the smartest, most restless camera style in the business. Bertolucci's new film, Little Buddha, is about a Tibetan monk's search for the reincarnation of an important Buddhist lama. He believes the reincarnate is a little boy in a typical American family in Seattle. Mixed in with this contemporary story is the tale of Siddhartha's mystical adventures on the path to enlightenment. The film stars Keanu Reeves as Siddhartha and Chris Isaak and Bridget Fonda as the young boy's parents. Bertolucci shot spectacular scenes in the Himalayas, in Nepal and Bhutan. He says the idea came from a newspaper story.
In the last few years, it happened to me to read on the papers that a little Spanish kid was found by a few Tibetan lamas to be the reincarnation of Lama Yeshe, a famous lama, a scholar, a writer, who died exactly the same moment, more or less, when the little Spanish kid was born. And I started to get interested in this relationship between the lamas, Tibetan lamas, who go around the world hunting for little kids who can be the reincarnation of their teachers. And that made me very curious. And so I started to look around and to read about Buddhism, to read about reincarnation. And in 91, I went to meet with the Dalai Lama and to tell him, because I was a bit nervous, you know, I'm not a Buddhist. So I went to see him, to tell him, in fact, to ask him, if it was possible that somebody non-Buddhist, as I am, could do a movie on Buddhism.
What did he say?
Oh, he laughed at me and said, of course, you will have a fantastic level of Buddhist detachment because you are not Buddhist. You know, the Dalai Lama is invincible. He's not only him, I must say, all these Tibetan lamas I met have such a kind of strong joie de vivre. They are so jolly and so playful. You know, the joie de vivre is something that maybe, I don't know in general, but personally, I thought I had lost. You know, when I'd done Shelter in Sky, which is the last movie I've done before Little Buddha, it was so painful, and really there was no joie de vivre in that film. And you know, it was very important because he opened my mind a bit, especially on something which is a little detail, but very important. There is a word that the Dalai Lama, all the Buddhists, use a lot, and you heard it a lot in the film, which is the word compassion. You know, for my generation, the word compassion has always been a bit not very interesting, you know. Because my generation used to like other words, like transgression, revolution, provocations. And compassion was a bit boring. After that meeting, I came out having understood that in Buddhist terms, compassion is a very high form of intelligence. Compassion is what, how would I say? It's the complete, profound understanding of the suffering of the other people. And that was very important for me. And then I met the Dalai Lama two more times. Once during the editing, because we had a problem. Some Buddhists in Nepal were accusing us because they didn't like the title Little Buddha. And I said, why? They said, because Buddha is great, is not little. And so I thought that was a bit too naive, this way of judging the title. So I went to see the Dalai Lama, and he asked me, why did you call it Little Buddha? I said, because I want really to be a film that even children can see. You know, I want it to be the basic manual for Buddhism. And so that's why I call it Little Buddha. And he said, keep the title. He said, you know, I think there is a little Buddha in all of us. Which is also something else which I learned from him, which is that the Buddhists think that there is something called the Buddhahood, which is the Buddha nature, that each one, every one of us has it inside. But the fact is that he's asleep. You know, if we are able to wake up this Buddha nature, we all could be Buddha. And that was the second time I met him. The third time was when I finished the film and I wanted to show it to him. And we did a screening with a lot of invitations, and it was a charity in Paris in a big, huge theater with a huge screen. And the Dalai Lama came and gave a little speech before, and he said, thank you for being here, Tenga. And he said, I must confess you, this is the first time I walk into a movie theater.
He'd never been in a theater before.
No, and everybody was, wow, gosh. And so I sat next to him, and I watched him instead of watching the movie because it was so interesting to see.
What? How did he react?
He reacted like a child. I mean, laughing, becoming very tense, taking my hand. And I was thinking, look how strange it is. I'm assisting to the initiation in cinema of the man who is the great initiator of all Buddhists. And now I was there sitting next to him and witnessing to his cinema initiation. It was fascinating. And at the end of the film, he was like emotional. You know, this after this, you see the bowl with the ashes floating on the ocean in the bay in front of Seattle, etc. And he grabbed my head and cracked my finger and said, wonderful, wonderful. Hmm. And he stood up and he disappeared in a cloud of bodyguards.
I'm speaking with Bernardo Bertolucci, and his latest film is called Little Buddha. I want to talk a little bit about your life and some of the other films that you've made. Your father is a poet and a film critic. Was it he who introduced you to films?
Yeah, he took me to see my first movies when I was very young. You know, we were living in the countryside next to a city in northern Italy called Parma. He was the critic of the Parma Gazette, but he was especially a poet. So to start, when I was able to write, I started to write poems like him, just in order to imitate my father. Then when I was 16, somebody gave me a 16 mil, and I did my little first 10-minute feature film. And I understood that poetry didn't belong to me, belonged to him, and that cinema was much more mine. So
Let me ask you about something you said, and this is about your father. No matter how I tried to rebel as a child, he was a step ahead and approved whatever I did. So he made rebellion impossible?
Exactly. That's why I had to make movies about rebellion, because in life it was Impossible. It was too smart.
So once you started making movies, you stopped writing poetry?
Yeah, for what I told you. There is a kind of... I didn't feel comfortable. First of all, I thought he was a much better poet than me. And then I thought that I could be a better director than him, who wasn't a director at all. You know, the competition between sons and fathers. And in fact, the father figure is very present in almost all my movies. And there are some of these movies which are really based on a struggle, on a search, on a fight, on a, I don't know, yeah. They call it Oedipal.
Well, what does your father think about your movies?
Oh, you know, he doesn't say it, but I think that deeply he feels that he has done it.
Hmm. Do you mind that?
No.
Sharing the glory with him?
No, it's very good because in some of the poems that he wrote in the last 20 years, I could feel there was some influence from my movies. So that was to give and to have back, you know. But, you know, he's the one who told me in a very simple way, without ever being, let's say, academic or heavy teacher. He told me what poetry is, you know. Once when I was, I don't know, 8 or 9, he showed me a poem that he wrote about my mother called The White Rose. And he compares my mother to the white rose which is in the bottom of the garden. He says, the last bees of the summer visited and et cetera, et cetera. So I am very young. I go out. I run to the bottom of the garden. And I see there is a white rose. What happens? That for me, so young, there is no more difference between poetry, which is written, and reality, which is in the bottom of the garden. So that, it was a lesson to see poetry in life, you know, to see what is poetic in the daily life, in everything that happens to us.
I read that you were in analysis for 22 years, is that right?
And you say it like that to everybody? This is very unfair, but now you said it. You know, Freud wrote an essay called Terminable Analysis and Interminable Analysis. I think I'm more the second case.
Well, I'm tempted to say, what took you so long? But what did you get out of that analysis, and how has that helped you as a filmmaker?
I started in the end of the late 60s. After the 3 or 4 movies I've done in the 60s, which were so hermetic, kind of a bit obscure. I think not bad, but I couldn't communicate with an audience. It was like shouting screams in the desert and having no echo, okay? It was like feeling that I was doing a monologue, and I felt quite unhappy because of that. I started the analysis in 69, and I think that it helped me a lot to go from monologue to dialogue, to be able to accept the idea that a movie can have an audience which reacts to it, etc. You know, the cinema in the 60s was, I think, very, very... It was in a very, very important moment because it was when with Godard and Truffaut and, you know, all the new wave, the French new wave, cinema has been changed in some way, you know. It's been... the approach from cinema to life became something completely new, completely different from the classic cinema. So it was fascinating. It was really a kind of feverish moment for myself. And I was feeling I was like a guerrilla of cinema, etc. Then at the end of the 60s, I told you, I felt a bit sterile, like not having communication. And the analysis not only helped me to have more communication in life, but help my movies to be more communicative, you know.
I want to talk some more, but first we have to take a short break. My guest on Fresh Air today is filmmaker Bernardo Bertolucci, the director of such films as Last Tango in Paris, Luna, The Last Emperor, The Sheltering Sky, and his latest movie called Little Buddha. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with filmmaker Bernardo Bertolucci. I want to talk about Last Tango in Paris, which you made in the early 70s. When you made that film, were you aware that it was going to be as controversial as it was?
Not at all.
Were you interested in challenging conventions at all?
Not at all. Maybe there was some little pleasure in transgression, but that wasn't really the reason why I did the movie. I did the movie, you know, as I do all my movies are kind of a moment of my life, tranche de vie, you know. In that moment of my life, I felt that I was fed up with relationships which were kind of a social relationship. And so I had the idea of a couple which is trying to have a relationship which is not based on the social identities, but let's say, let's find a kind of empty place which doesn't belong to any of us. And we meet there. We don't know our names. We don't know who we are outside this empty place. And let's try to communicate just with the language of our bodies. So it was a very, today I think it was a very romantic attempt. Romantic and also very destructive, because in fact it ends very tragically. But what happened is that I remember seeing the film, the rough cut of the film, three people, my editor and co-writer, Franco Arcalli, myself, and the producer, Alberto Grimaldi. I remember me and my editor looking at us at the end and saying, oh my God, what have we done? It's so gloomy. Who will care about this? I was when I did it, I was, I don't know, 30, 31. I said, this old man, he was just more or less the age I am now, hanging out in Paris, really a bit fat, a bit. And then we turn and we see the producer was having his little own private dance, very happy in the bottom, in the back of the theater. And he said, you'll see.
So he knew.
But I didn't at all. I mean, really.
Well, let me ask you something, and I'm sure you've heard this before, because Marlon Brando, who stars in that film, is reported to have said that he felt raped after the making of the film. Do you know what he's referring to?
I don't know, first of all, if he can have said that, because he's a man of such pride that I doubt he said it. But anyway, if he said it, is that... The raped person was very much the accomplice of the rapist in that case, because I was much younger than Marlon. He was much more experienced than me. What I done was just to try to have not the Marlon Brando Strasbourg actor studio persona in front of my camera, you know. I wanted Marlon, the Marlon I was having dinner every evening with, and the guy I knew outside the acting. That's why I think that is a kind of rare case, Last Tango in Paris, when Marlon is showing himself in some way. Even if I met him no more than 2 months ago and I told him again, so I stole some of your truth. He said, haha, you think you did. But anyway, I was completely in love with him. I was, I mean, I was so...
I think he gives a wonderful performance.
Yeah, it's very different from everything mm-hmm. is done before. But what? You know what happened? Just a little thing in Italy. Maybe you didn't know it. For that film in Italy, I've been condemned for obscenity to 2 months of prison with suspension. So I didn't. And I lost my civil rights for 5 years. I was unable to vote for 5 years. That's why I'm very, very wounded on that. And I'm very much against censorship.
Well, the film was banned, wasn't it, until 1987?
Exactly.
In Italy.
Exactly. It came out again in 87, 88. Mm-hmm.
Let me try another quote on you, and this is from John Malkovich, a quote from Making the Sheltering Sky with you. And he said, talking about you, Bernardo Bertolucci, he's a charming guy, a great conversationalist, but treacherous as a snake. You've got to expect that anything said in confidence at dinner, a party, or during a moment of introspection will come back at you at an appropriate moment on the set. Do you, as a director, then feel entitled to everything?
I mean, you know, we are together with the actors for 10, 16, 20 weeks, depends. And I try really to, if I can there, to fall in love with all of them in some way. I mean, I'm not talking about sexual love, but to be in love with them, to be in love with my actors. With the heroes, with the goodies, but also with the baddies. So I'm really what John Malkovich says, that if I am amazed by something I hear during dinner or during out of the set, it could be very possible that this thing comes back as a line in the film. I think that the suggestions of the reality are the more interesting for me. You know, the script is there. And also, this is why I want to have really very well-written, solid screenplays. Because if my screenplay is... if I feel very safe and sure with the screenplay, I can really allow myself for a lot of improvisation.
I just have really one more question for you, because unfortunately we're out of time, but did you really mean to refer to Hollywood as the big nipple when you accepted the Academy Award for The Last Emperor?
Oh, my God. First of all, I must tell you, and when I said in front of this thousand of people sitting in this Hollywood shrine, tonight for me, it was, I don't know, the ninth Academy Award that The Last Emperor was getting. Is like a big nipple. I mean, for me, it was very clear, but there was something like between 7 and 10 seconds of silence, which made me feel really. I said, oh, my God, what did they say? Why they don't laugh? And then they started to laugh and applaud, and they laughed a lot.
That's a great image.
But, you know, but for 10 seconds, a certain kind of American Puritanism didn't allow the audience to react. They were kind of embarrassed, and then they let them go. And, you know, for Americans, the Oscar is a really major, major thing. For European, it's not our thing. And for me, it was like a children game, you know. It was like being a child again and playing and having incredible gratification, but in a kind of mythological way. It wasn't realistic.
Well, Bernardo Bertolucci, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Bernardo Bertolucci's latest film is Little Buddha. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Artie Moscowain with Fresh Air. Coming up, the sorriest pro baseball team around. We talk with pitcher Lisa Martinez and manager Phil Niekro of the first all-female pro baseball team, the Silver Bullets. Niekro says the women had to learn to stop saying, "I'm sorry," when they made mistakes, the kind of mistakes that all ball players make. The Silver Bullets are playing against men's teams in the minor leagues, and last night in their fourth game, they scored their first run. Also, world music commentator Milo Miles reviews the music of bossa nova guitarist Baden Powell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton says China and the United States are still discussing human rights issues. The matter is a litmus test for China, which wants to keep trading with the United States. UPI's Bill Small has this report.
Mr. Clinton says he's not yet decided whether to renew China's preferential trade status and that discussions are still going on. And he avoided a question on whether China's leaders have indicated any willingness to make concessions on human rights.
I don't think I should speak for the Chinese. All I can tell you is that there are some things which have been reported which have actually occurred, and we've had discussions about other matters, but I don't think I should discuss them now. We're still in discussions with them.
Mr. Clinton says he'll make his decision on China's trade status in what he calls a timely fashion. His aide suggests the decision should be announced before he goes to Europe for the 50th anniversary commemoration of D-Day. Bill Small at the White House.
United States and Japanese negotiators are trying to break a 3-month-old trade deadlock. U.S. officials have been optimistic about a possible breakthrough. Washington has been quiet recently over its trade woes with Japan, but administration officials insist they're not retreating from their goal of opening Japan's markets to U.S. goods and services. They also want to cut the staggering trade gap with Tokyo. Trade talks broke down last February. Caterpillar Incorporated says it's hiring new workers, but the company says the new hires are not intended to replace striking United Auto Workers. Carl Volz, a member station WCBU, reports from Peoria, Illinois.
Caterpillar says it's hiring or recalling about 1,500 workers in Illinois, but the company was careful to stress that the new hires won't necessarily replace those UAW members on strike. Company Vice President Wayne Zimmerman.
What we're doing today is first going through our recall list, and we'll exhaust those employees, and then we'll come back and consider hiring employees.
Zimmerman says hiring permanent replacements for the 7,500 UAW workers on strike is still an option. The UAW maintains that it would be illegal for CAT to hire replacements because the union says their strike is an unfair labor practice strike. For National Public Radio, this is Carl Volz in Peoria, Illinois.
Members of the Kennedy family are traveling to see former First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. She's checked out of a New York hospital. A spokeswoman says doctors can do nothing more to fight her lymph node cancer. A priest has administered the sacrament for the sick, which was formerly known as Last Rites to Mrs. Onassis. It can be given to Catholics who are gravely ill. On Wall Street, a strong bond market has rather drove stock prices higher for the third straight day. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 26 points to end at 3,758. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. Former Exxon chairman Lawrence Rawl says he didn't know what he was saying in his first statements on the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Weeks after the super oil tanker ran aground off the coast of Alaska, Rawl said Captain Joseph Hazelwood was drunk at the time. Now Alaska residents are suing Hazelwood and the oil company for billions of dollars. Rawl says he made that statement under pressure and on the basis of bad information. Rawl also discounted his earlier statements that Hazelwood shouldn't have been commanding oil tankers after being treated for alcohol abuse. Large crowds in Malawi are celebrating the downfall of President Hastings Banda, their ruler of 30 years. Banda went on the radio to acknowledge defeat in Malawi's first democratic elections held on Tuesday. Penny Richards reports for the BBC.
Ever since Dr. Banda's address to the nation, the streets of Blantyre have been filled with people, all celebrating the end of the reign of Africa's longest-serving dictator. Already, the new president and head of the United Democratic Front, Bikile Mlozi, has said his new government will not be investigating past abuses from Dr. Banda's regime. The new era of democracy in Malawi has arrived in the main at the instigation of international aid donors. Many Western countries have been withholding much-needed donations to the country until the promise of a multi-party state becomes a reality. Mr. Mlozi admitted one of the first jobs of the new administration would be to work towards the restoration of that overseas aid.
Penny Richards reporting. Egyptian officials say at least 8 people have died in a ship fire in the Gulf of Suez. The Egyptian Navy also says more than 50 people are hurt. Authorities say most of the 588 people aboard the burning ferry are accounted for. A U.S. Navy ship picked up more than 100 survivors. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Many little boys dream of growing up and playing professional baseball. With the creation of the Colorado Silver Bullets, now little girls can have those same dreams. The Silver Bullets is the first all-female team recognized to compete against men in the minor leagues, which banned women from playing in 1953. Their season opened this month, and they're scheduled to play some 50 exhibition games against over 30 semi-pro and minor league teams. The 24-member Silver Bullets is backed by the Coors Brewing Company. Their first few games have demonstrated that they have a long way to go to compete equally against more seasoned male players. Last night, they scored their first run of the season. We caught up with pitcher Lisa Martinez and manager Phil Niekro right before last night's game. Niekro is a veteran of the major leagues. He pitched for the Atlanta Braves and was a 5-time Golden Glove winner. He retired in 1987 from the majors at the age of 48. Lisa Martinez played softball through high school and college and went as far as she could go professionally in the sport. She had stopped playing softball when she heard about the tryouts for the Silver Bullets. I asked her what those tryouts were like.
Tryouts, gosh, I was supposed to try out right near my hometown in Sacramento, and the tryouts were scheduled to be from 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock, and I guess they changed the time like the day or this two before, and I got there and the tryouts were finished. You know, they had had them from 10 to 1 instead, so I didn't realize until that point how much I actually wanted to do this, because I was devastated, to say the least, and that's when I made plans, when's the next time I could go, and so I went to try out in Denver.
What did you see in Lisa Martinez, who's one of your pitchers?
Well, I was not at the tryout camp when they got signed. I was back in the land with some other previous engagements. All I know is when I talked to Tommy Jones, who is our player coordinator, who left the Chicago Cubs organization to come with us, and my brother Joe Niekro, who's my pitching coach, when I talked to them after the workout, they said, you got to see this young lady throw, but she throws underhand like a softball. And at first I thought, well, how can someone do that? I've never seen anyone in baseball do that before. And they were telling me how she throws and the velocity she had and what her ball does. And they said, we signed her and we're going to bring in the spring training camp. So I think probably of all the people that we had signed and brought to spring training camp, I guess I was more curious than anyone about what I'm going to see as far as what a lady can do with a baseball throwing like a softball.
Let me ask you, Lisa, because you said until you signed with the Silver Bullets, you'd always played softball.
Right.
You've never pitched overhand?
No. Actually, you know, they would have, when I was in Denver, and maybe the first day of spring training, they would have me throw like 2 minutes overhand, 2 minutes underhand, you know, and then back and forth. And then pretty much by the second or third day, they were having me just throw underhand, Lisa.
What do you get with an underhand pitch that you don't get with an overhand?
Well, my ball, my fastball is a natural sinker, so it pretty, you know, just pretty much drops, you know, off. And then I have my curve, which is probably similar to a baseball slider, and I have a knuckleball. And I haven't tried any of my other, I had a few other pitches with softball, but I haven't tried them or worked on them. You know, I just worked on the three that I'm pitching now.
Now, Phil, what do you see with Lisa's pitching? Which you say is unusual.
I see a ball that has very much movement from under there. I was surprised that the ball moved that well from under there. Her curveball she gets that under control, she's going to be even better pitcher than she is right now. She has a knuckleball, which she does very well for a changeup. So she's got three pitches going. The thing that's so unique about that is maybe not throwing the ball that way, but the reaction from the batters who we've played so far is they've never seen the ball come from under there. Normally you see a baseball throw an overhand or a three-quarter or a sidearm and maybe a little underhand, but nothing from the style that she's throwing it from. And a lot of batters are very confused because they just don't know what that ball's going to do under there. They can't pick it up. It's a ball that you just don't see until it leaves almost from the right knee in Lisa's case. So they're having a hard time adjusting to that pitch. And she's made some batters look very bad this year for the simple reason it's not the speed, but it's just the location where it's coming from, the movement on the ball. And they've just never seen that before in their whole lifetime.
Lisa, did it take some time to get used to holding a baseball as compared to a softball?
The holding, it wasn't too bad. I would say the most difficult thing for me was the first time I stood on a mound. The way when you pitch a softball, you usually are standing on the ground, you know, and it's a very upward movement. You know, you drive with your legs up. And baseball is more of a falling down the hill movement, so they're totally contradictory. So the toughest thing, I remember the first time I tried it, I thought I wrenched my knee, my ankle, my Achilles right out, and then I tried it again, not stepping as hard as I used to. It's just a matter of getting used to it.
Well, we're going to just take a short break, and we'll be right back. And our guests on Fresh Air today are Lisa Martinez. She's a pitcher with the Colorado Silver Bullets. We're also joined by Phil Niekro, who's manager of the team. And the Bullets is the first women's professional baseball team to compete completely against men. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Phil Niekro. He's manager of the Colorado Silver Bullets and also with Lisa Martinez, who's a pitcher for the team, and the Colorado Bullets, the first women's professional baseball team to compete against men. Let me ask you, Phil, about what it's like to coach a team of women. Now, you played with the Atlanta Braves. What would you say is some of the big contrasts?
Well, people ask me that, and that's probably probably a lot of answers for that, but I don't see a whole lot of difference other than these women are so much more coachable than the guys are. If I took 24 guys who never played the game and 24 women, probably the 24 guys would not have the ears and the eyes to see and hear what we're showing the women. They'd have, but they probably wouldn't have the patience. These women want to go out in the morning at daybreak and then at dark. They can't hit enough balls. They can't swing the bat enough. They can't take enough ground balls. They can't take enough fly balls. They want to get as much as they can within their systems as they possibly can. Men wouldn't do that. Men's always get that little ego problem. Okay, I can hit the ball and I can catch it. They might need to practice a little bit more to sharpen their skills, but the patience, they just don't have the patience. They don't have the show me, show me, show me, tell me everything you can about the game like the women do.
Now, I read that you've had to deal with the fact that women often apologize if they make a mistake. You've had to try to teach them how to not apologize. Is that right?
Well, yeah, and we still have that sometimes.
I'm sorry.
It's true, Lisa, right?
We're having some of the women making a bad throw or not doing what they think they should, saying I'm sorry to the other player on the ball club. They'll make a bad throw to first base and will kind of holler out in a slow way, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to throw it down there. They just don't realize that they're going to make a lot of errors. They're going to make mistakes, and they're going to look foolish. They're going to make bad pitches, but that's the nature of the game.
Lisa, is that a hard habit to break, to stop saying I'm sorry?
I was probably one of the worst that was guilty of it. And so I think that I was one of the first people they probably said something to about that. You know, an occasional "I'm sorry" still slips out, but probably not as much as it used to.
Now, I heard of actually one of the players hit a triple, and when she got to third base, she hugged the third base coach. Is that right, Phil?
That was the spring training, our first game that we played, and had the young lady hit the ball in the gap and ran over third base, and I think she was so excited that, that she hit the baseball with a wooden bat between the fielders and rounded first, second, and third, and when she got to third, she was so excited she jumped into the arms of the third base coach.
What was your reaction?
Well, everybody just... say, what am I looking? What am I seeing here? You know, I think those are things that you don't do in softball. But I think she was so excited and so relieved that she got a hit and she drove the ball further than she did. And right after that game, we went in and definitely had a meeting. That was the last time we saw that. We won't see it no more. I think probably that they just don't realize that when they do those things and make good plays and hit the ball hard and make big strikeouts in situations, that to a certain degree that's what they get paid for. That's what they're expected to do. So, you know, don't let the people know or your fans know, like, God, that's the first time in my life I've ever done this. And that's what they were doing there for a while. They were congratulating each other on the field when they made a good play. There was almost times we had a call timeout so all the players can congratulate the other player on the team on the outfield for making good play. You know.
You agree, Lisa, with what he's saying?
Oh, that happened at the very beginning when we first started doing a few inter-squad scrimmages. It's definitely toned down since then. You know, we're excited when something happens, but we try and wait, you know, for them to come into the dugout to tell them.
How have your opponents treated you? And when you're actually playing the game, do they look on you or treat you like a kid sister? Do they treat you like a real team, if you know what I mean?
It's different reactions from different players. I felt some people have, like the team that we're going to be playing this evening, they're a little bit older and have played, they're ex-major leaguers, and some will give comments to you, actually being helpful, maybe like a, you know, an older brother. I've noticed that just a little bit. A lot of times, they won't talk to you at all. They don't want to be beaten by girls by any means, and they're going to do everything they can, you know, to prevent that. So they're out there to play ball. Just a wide variety of reactions.
And I'm curious for you, Phil, how other managers treat you.
Well, I you know, before the game starts, Marty, we explained to them before the game at home plate that, you know, let's just play the game as the way the game of baseball is supposed to be played. We're not looking for any favors. Don't take a dive for us. Don't throw the game just because you're beating the heck out of us. You know, we can accept that. We can handle that. We're grown-ups. You know, whatever comes our way, we can handle it, and we'll adjust to it as the season goes along. The only thing that I tell them is that just treat the game like it is. You know, we don't harass your players, don't harass ours. Don't get to the point where you're going to make a circus or a joke out of this game. If it does, then we're going to have a problem with that. But we've had a problem with one guy who was a high school coach at Bartow High School in Florida, played left field when we played an exhibition game down there. And he got so bad and nasty in the outfield, I guess maybe he just didn't want to be there, that he made so many wisecracks to our players that, you know, we mentioned something about to their coach over there in the fourth and fifth inning. They just ran him off the ball club. He just took his spikes and his glove and went home. And there was a high school coach. And that's the only problem we've had. Everyone's been very good to us. Everyone's been excited. And the players have been professionals and gentlemen on and off the field with it. And they're all excited to see this program work.
Can you imagine a woman playing in the major leagues?
Sure. I mean, could people imagine Jackie Robinson playing in the big leagues?
That's how you see it?
Well, sure. Who could? Whoever thought there'd be a lady driving in the Indy 500? Whoever thought there'd be a lady horse jockey? And they've been riding horses in the Belmonts or Preakness. They've done that, so. The only reason you haven't seen that, or people can't imagine anyone doing that, Marty, is because the opportunity has never been there. It's here now. Coors Brewing Company has opened the window, opened the door in this country to at least give women an opportunity to find out. You don't find out in a month. You don't find out in 5 or 6 months. You don't find out in a year. It may take 2 or 3 or 4 years for someone to get to that point. But I do believe that there are women in this country that are well, good enough athletes or will be good enough athletes to play high in the minor leagues. And from there, it's just a matter of what the ball club thinks that they can play in the big leagues or not.
Well, I wish you the best of luck, and I thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Marty, thanks for talking with us.
Lisa Martinez is a pitcher, and Phil Niekro is the manager of the Colorado Silver Bullets, the first all-female team to play against men in the minor league. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about some of the stories they'll be covering on All Things Considered today. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Marty. Maria Hinojosa has this story about the legal battle between New York State and New Jersey over Ellis Island. Actually, which state is Ellis Island actually in? And Bob Garfield has a story about ordinary people auditioning to host a television talk show. It's sort of a nationwide talent search. We'll have letters from listeners about Eritrea and political correctness and hippopotamuses and tick riders in Texas. And I'll talk with Ray Connie, master of the slack key guitar. That has a very distinctive Hawaiian sound.
Noah, thanks. Those stories are more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It could be said that the bossa nova was one of the early forms of world music. 30 years ago, it emerged from Brazil, caught on, and blended with musical styles around the world. World music commentator Milo Miles looks at old and new releases by a guitarist associated with the bossa nova, Baden Powell.
Baden Powell has been claimed by fans of many styles, jazz, bossa nova, pop, samba, classical, and world fusion. But that's all right, because Powell has embraced all those styles and more. He has been called the most Brazilian of musicians. And perhaps that reflects his supreme ease and dignity with so many diverse elements in his playing. With some of his best sides back in print, Powell may even finally become more than a cult figure in North America. Powell was born in Rio in 1937. His father was the leader of the local Boy Scout troop and named his son after the founder of the Boy Scouts, Englishman Robert Thompson Baden Powell. The guitarist began doing his good deeds with the hit Samba Triste in 1959, but he earned serious merit badges after he teamed up with the older poet and diplomat Vinicius de Moraes in 1962. As songwriters, they gave a crucial boost to Afro-consciousness in Brazil with their series of Afro-sambas, like the famous Canto de Isana. Powell became a sensation in Germany during the 1960s, and some of his earliest non-Brazilian albums came out on the German MPS label. Now Verve Records has reissued a trio of these collections on 2 CDs called Three Originals, and they are a feast. The first album, Tristeza on Guitar, includes treats like Canto de Osana, the title cut, and the jaunty O Astronauta. With some light touches of bass, percussion, and flute for accompaniment, Tristeza is Powell's most lyrical collection, flawless in every way. The second album, Poemas on Guitar, is split between the two CDs, which is all right because its style is transitional. The final set, Appassionato, is Powell at his most experimental. He's both jungle steamy and modernist cool on tracks like Abstrato. There's no doubt Powell's most creative period lasted from the early 60s to the middle 70s, but he's far from irrelevant today. His newest American release is a collection of ballads called Serestra Brasileira, or Brazilian Serenades. Powell proves that age is no barrier to romance, and experience can enrich the details of longing. The guitarist explores many moods, all of them intimate, but strengthened by his potent stroke on the bass strings. Most of the selections are songs he wrote long ago with Demores, some in their third or fourth version. But whispers of tenderness and mortality are brought out to keep the treatments fresh. As long as his flow of ideas continues, time cannot dim or weaken the mastery of Baden-Powell.
Milo Miles is a freelance critic based in Boston. He reviewed two releases by Baden-Powell, three originals on the Verve label, and Serestra Brasileira on Milestone. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy and Nancy Greenlees. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. For Terry Gross, I'm Artie Moskowayne.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature our interview with James Cameron, founder of America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee. 63 years ago in Marion, Indiana, Cameron narrowly escaped being lynched. He's the author of Time of Terror, a survivor's story. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.